American Baseball Research, and today is November 22nd, 1999, and I'm in the home of Dick Hall, who lives in Timonium, Maryland. How old are you, Dick?
69.
Okay. And where were you born?
St. Louis, Missouri. Uh-huh. Lived there 5 weeks. I didn't stay long.
And then where did you move to?
Albany, New York for about 5 years, then Northern Bergen County, New Jersey until I was 15, and moved to Baltimore.
Uh-huh. When did you get interested in baseball?
I've always been a little kid and everything, grew up playing softball and so forth.
Have any brothers or sisters?
No other athletes in the family.
Okay. And how about high school? Where did you go to high school?
I went briefly to Tenafly High School, a year and a half in Tenafly, New Jersey, and then 2.5 years to Mount Hermon School in Massachusetts.
Presume you played on the
team? Yeah.
And what position did you play?
I was a pitcher outfielder all the way through school and semi-pro and everything. I would pitch when it was my turn and play the outfield when it wasn't.
Did you have any outstanding years?
Pretty good, yeah. I had I grew up playing softball, and the first hardball I ever played was after I came here to Baltimore. And I played for the Glenn L. Martin boys team, the Red Shield 14-16 team, and we won the Cardinal Gibbons championship that year. And that was my first taste of baseball.
And do you have any favorite team or players growing up?
When I was young, lived right outside New York, and Fridays used to be Ladies' Day in all the New York parks. So mother liked baseball, so I'd go to 50 cents. You go to the Friday afternoon game. It was all day games in those days. And I'd go to the Polo Grounds and the Yankee Stadium. Well, I think we went to Ebbets Field once.
Did you have any favorite team?
I guess I like the Giants. I think Mel Ott, maybe.
And how did you get into organized baseball?
Well, the scouts come around. If you're halfway decent, at that time there were 16 teams. I think 15 of them contacted me. They find you.
So you sort of had your choice there.
Yeah.
Now I understand Branch Rickey signed.
Yeah. I signed with Pittsburgh. They've been scouting me. In fact, the same scout, the Rex Bowen, was a Dodger scout, and then he went over to Pittsburgh with Ricky, and he scouted me, and then Branch Jr. came around to see me and so forth. And I went out, actually stayed a few days at Mr. Ricky's home in 51, fall of 51 out of Pittsburgh, signed just before my senior year of college.
Had you been in college then?
Yeah, I went 3 years of college before I signed.
Where'd you go to college?
Swarthmore College. Swarthmore, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I'm sure you played on the team there.
Yeah. We had a big schedule, like 13 games we played. Wow. I think both my second and third years, I had 464. Last year, I had a real good year. I had like a .067 ERA, averaged 15 strikeouts a game. 13 games, I had 7 home runs and 28 RBIs. That was fun.
So you were still pitching and playing?
Yes, I would play, but we played just like college. We played 2 games a week, and I played to pitch one game and play the outfield the other.
Okay, now when they signed you, did they have any special, when you signed as a pitcher or as
Ricky was one of the, most clubs wanted to sign as a pitcher, but Mr. Ricky was one that thought I might be able to be an outfielder, and originally he started off trying to make me an infielder, outfielder, and I didn't actually start pitching until my fourth year of pro ball.
And what's your impression of Mr. Ricky?
I figure there's 3 men have had more effect on baseball than anybody in history. A.J. Spaulding, that really started the professional league, Branch Rickey, and Marvin Miller. And Mr. Rickey, I didn't realize at the time, but he was one of the most innovative minds and tremendous public speaker. If you've been in politics or something, you've been a senator, or been a bank president, if you've been in that. really a lot of insight into baseball.
Now, when since a lot of teams were in demand, or you were in demand for a lot of teams, did you get some sort of bonus?
Yeah, I got some. Yeah, there wasn't draft wasn't in effect then. I got about $25,000, which I guess present day would be $100,000.
Now you started. This was 1952.
Yeah.
You started right with Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I went. My plan was to go out to spring training. I took. In fact, that fall they had, Mr. Ricky had a special camp down in the land, Florida, and I went down there for a couple of weeks. And then we had a 2-week spring vacation, and I took 3 weeks off from school, so that I was going to go to spring training for 5 weeks, come back, finish school, and then go play minor league ball in June. But I had a good time. I hit against Sal Magley and Bob Lemon and... playing first base and having a good time. I hit like 300 in spring training, and all of a sudden Mr. Ricky came to me just at the end of it, and he said, well, in those days you could, like, now you bring guys up in September. In those days you could carry extra players for the first 30 days of the season, plus the last 30 days, which is still the same. And he said, you can stay with Pittsburgh in the big leagues if you stay with us. So I said, well, I only got one semester left, so I stayed with Pittsburgh, and my very first games with them were at Pittsburgh.
You remember your first game?
Well, yeah, actually, I had never played infield at all, a little bit of first base. And Mr. Ricky suddenly said, I bet he could play third base. Never played it before in my life. But one exhibition game in Washington, and then my second game at third base ever was opening day in St. Louis. Ralph Kiner's hitting fourth, I was hitting fifth, and so that was my first game. I hit the ball hard the first time up, and that was it. I never got too nervous.
Who was the pitcher?
Jerry Staley. Had a two sidearm, it looked like it snaked about 8 times.
When you were with Swarthmore, did you play with or anybody who eventually made it to the majors?
No, there were. I played summer college ball up in Massachusetts, like the Cape Cod League. Back in those days, there were several leagues like that. I played the Blackstone Valley League, which was sort of mill towns near south of, between Worcester and Rhode Island. And I think there were some guys from that league that I'm trying to think of. Morgan, the manager of Boston, played there. I can't think, it was a catcher. I'm getting senile. I'm having a senior moment, that's right. I can't remember names anymore.
Okay. Now, when you signed, you got your bonus with Ricky. You're supposed to be a pretty hard negotiator as far as the rest of the contract.
He was, but you wouldn't know it talking to him. Very, very personable. And just having a conversation with him was like listening to a senator speak or something. Tremendous speaker. And one of his arguments, the sooner you sign, you make your money at the end of your career. So the sooner you sign, the more you'll make at the end, so it doesn't hurt to sign early.
Okay, so you were at Pittsburgh for about a month or so, was it? Or
yes, I went out cut down day.
Uh-huh. And then you went to Burlington Graham.
Yes, and played shortstop, which I never played before. Led the league in one department, errors.
Okay. What classification was that?
That's Carolina League, same as it is now. It was, at that time it was B, but it's the same as like Frederick. Exactly same league that Frederick's in.
And who is the manager?
No. Good question. I forget.
okay. And then the next year, you were back with Pittsburgh in 53.
Well, briefly. In other words, they called me up at the end of 52. And then, no, 53, I just got called up in September for a couple of few weeks. And I played at Longview, Texas, same classification level. It was a Waco ball club, but a tornado blew the ballpark down, and they moved it to Longview that year. So I played, it was a big state league, all Texas town.
Any of the opponents or teammates make it to the majors?
Not too many. At Burlington Graham, Bull Durham movie, our team might have, we had a composite, some pitchers on that team that might have made a nice composite of the pitcher, and I think Ron Netschai had pitched, was an A-ball that year in Welch, or someplace, West Virginia, threw a no-hitter, struck out 27 batters, and brought him up to Burlington later that season, and he was, drew a lot of fans. Interesting. He played briefly in the big leagues, but not very long. Ronnie Klein was on the team. He played in the big leagues a long time.
And then 54, you were with Pittsburgh pretty much the whole season?
Yes, I played outfield. Platoon in left field with Jerry Lynch. And I got about, 300 times or so.
310.
Okay. Hit 239 with two home runs.
Okay. Who were the homers?
I remember all, I had four total in the big league. First one was Ernie Johnson, that was later the broadcaster for Atlanta, and he threw a high inside changeup, sidearm, and I pulled it right down the left field line in Milwaukee for a home run. And then Johnny Antonelli hung a curveball in Polo Grounds, which I hit in the second deck, which is actually Polo Grounds, the second deck is closer than the first deck here.
Overhead.
Yeah.
Right. Who are some of your teammates in with Pittsburgh in those days?
Well,
Kiner.
Yeah, I guess by 54 he was going, I guess Bell, your father, Buddy Bell, played with him. And Bob Friend. Vern Law.
Wally Westlake?
No, he was just before me.
Bill Bearden?
No, he was just after me. Actually, I played briefly when I got called up, like 59 with him.
Clemente?
He came in 56, I believe. Pace came in 55, or 54. Clemente came in 55 or 56. And Marzocchi came later.
How about Vinegar Ben Mizell?
No, hit against him, because he was one of the left-handers. I hit against the left-handed pitchers. He was with St. Louis in that city.
So, 1955, you opened up with Lincoln.
Yeah. Actually, what happened, I started playing winter ball in Mazatlan, where my wife is from. In the winter of 53, 54, my first year down there, set a league home run record. I was playing second base and outfield.
How many did you hit?
Hit 20 in 80 games, which Luke Easter tied it the next year. And then the league folded, so I figured legally, I set they had some guys hit a lot more after the league started up again. So I hit pretty well. And that was the year before I played the outfield in Pittsburgh. And then that winter, I told the manager that I had pitched regularly in college, semi-pro and everything. We played four games on the weekend and had four pitchers. And then, the fifth pitcher wouldn't even play D-ball in the state. So I told him I might be able to bump up, and we have nine hitters. And got in a couple games, got them out, and won a couple. And Howie Haight, the super scout for Pittsburgh, saw me pitching. So the next spring they said, let's try to make a switch hitter out of him, which didn't work. Let's try to make a pitcher out of him, which did work. I went to Lincoln, which is the same level as Bowie. It was here now. In those days it was...
Was that Nebraska?
Yeah, it was the Western League. And I played left field. We had a five-man pitching rotation. I played left field 4 days in a row, and then the fifth day I would pitch. I'd pitch and back fifth. I had a good time. I hit 300, but I was a much better pitcher than hitter. Led that league, led the Western League in pitching. Got called up in the middle of the season, went in the starting rotation at Pittsburgh.
When you came back to Pittsburgh, who is the manager?
Well, let's see, 50. Let's see. When I was first there, it was Billy Myers, and then I guess 54 was Fred Haney. And then I'm not sure. I think Bobby Bragan came. I think he was. I know he was there in 56. I've forgotten now. 55, who was the manager? And then Murtaugh came, I got called up in 59, I was there a few weeks. Murtaugh was the manager by then.
So in 55, you pitched for Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And you were 6-6.
Yeah.
You remember your first game that you won?
Oh, yeah, the doubleheader, and I started against the Cubs. And first batter, I threw him a high strike, ball one. So I threw him a low strike, ball two. And I missed ball three, but then I came back, struck the guy out. And I was full of adrenaline. I came within, struck out 11, I think, which was in one of the Pittsburgh record at that time. And a whole bunch of strikeouts. So I gave up 5 runs, but we scored 12. So that was my first game.
Okay. And in 56?
Yeah, I went back down to Mexico. I hurt my arm that winter. And then 56, I had arm trouble all year. And started at the beginning of the season and didn't pitch very effectively. And,
Was it
0-7? I was 0-7, yeah. I just didn't, the arm wouldn't hold out. Sometimes I pitched 3 or 4 innings decent, but just didn't pitch well enough and lost everything. And then the next year was even worse. And I got, they shipped me, finally sent me off to Columbus in the middle of that season. But then the winter of 57-58, I had about a month off between the season and going back to winter ball. And my arm cleared up and I had like 10-1 record in winter ball and a 120 something ERA, which actually was, I got the league record home runs and the league record in ERA in the Mexican League. I figure not many people have two separate records like that.
Now, 1958, you took off.
I got hepatitis. I was supposed to play for Salt Lake and was sick. Came down with hepatitis in spring training, and the liver didn't. It just takes time to heal it, and it wasn't. They said, "Well, in October you'll be all right." So I missed the whole season.
Okay, 1959, you start off at Salt Lake.
Yeah, I pitched the whole year at Salt Lake that year, and got called up at the
end.
Yeah, MVP in the league and pitched very well. I had like four shutouts at Salt Lake, which is that altitude. That's
pretty hard.
Yeah.
Who was the manager then?
Larry Shepard. And one of the things, right at the end of the year, we won. Vancouver had about 8 guys that ended up playing the Orioles, and we caught them right at the end of the season. I remember tell people the story these days, and they don't not used to it then. But Larry Shepard, if you pitched the entire game, you won the game, and you didn't walk anybody, he'd give you $5. And I won $55 that year.
And then you came up to Pittsburgh, well, just sort of the end of the year.
Yeah, yeah. A
couple of games.
Yeah, pitched to Smokey Burgess. Pleasure. He's always famous for being a good hitter and not much a catcher, but I never had a catcher that was just immediately, he sensed how I pitched. And it was just like a real big league catcher. And, I was really shocked at how how he knew how to handle a pitcher he'd never seen before in his life.
What kind of salary are you making?
The bonus actually had guaranteed salary for a couple of years, and it was about the minimum in those days was about $5,000 or something. So I was making about the minimum.
Even though you've been around several years.
Well, up and down, yeah. Like at maybe 56, I might have got, I can't remember, I might have got a little raise.
And in 1960, you went over the American League.
Yeah, I got...
what happened?
Lovely trade. I was with Salt Lake and got traded that winter. Three of us, Kenny Hamlin and shortstop and Danny Kravitz, the catcher, went to Kansas City for Hal Smith, the catcher. So that was a very opportune trade. Kansas City came in last and Pittsburgh won the World Series.
Who was the manager of the Kansas City team?
Bob Elliott.
The one who played the Braves?
Yeah. Third baseman.
And you were 8-13.
Yeah, I started out real good. I was like 4-2 with a 2-something ERA, and then the arm trouble came back again, and I just struggled the rest. Every once in a while, I'd pitch a decent game, and then the arm would bother me for a few weeks. It would hold. It would have a lot of games. It would be all right for 3 or 4 innings, and then all of a sudden it just didn't have the velocity, and the control would disappear a little bit, and I'd lose another one.
And you were still a starting pitcher?
I was a starting pitcher pretty much all year. I think I might have gone to bullpen some that year later on.
Okay, now you were just with them for 1 year, and then you went to Baltimore.
Yeah, I got traded. Charlie Finley came the next year, and so I played spring training, and I played two days for Kansas City, I think. I traded like the second or third day of the season to Baltimore, which was a very opportune trade.
Did you get a chance to meet Finley? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He was quite a character. He had a lot of ideas, and kind of a mixed personality, I guess would be the best way to describe him.
Well, you got the Baltimore. Who was the manager?
Paul Richards.
That's a pretty smart fellow.
Yeah. He was good with pitchers, particularly. It was just starting to. Well, of course, the '60 was the year they had all the baby birds. I got traded for Jerry Walker, and Walker, Estrada, Pappas, and Jack Fisher had blossomed in '60. Orioles were finally just starting to become credible in those days.
And your first year, you were 7-5.
Yeah, I was mostly a starter. I was like fifth or sixth, about fifth, I guess, maybe fifth starter.
And then the next year, I believe in Baltimore for about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, 6 years. Winston.
Was that Brooke?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he just, I
Yeah. 1964 with Baltimore, maybe your best year, 9-1.
Yeah, I had like a 1.
Yeah, 1.84.
Yeah. That's probably my. Yeah, actually, what happened when I first got to Baltimore, I ended up playing with them 6 years, and then came back 69, 70, 71. And when I first got here, I was starting and like a fifth. Sixth starter or something, and then long man in the bullpen, and off and on, still having some arm trouble, started having a little elbow trouble, and I would pitch all right for a few innings, and I did a lot better relieving than I did starting, so gradually they just switched me over to being a relief pitcher, and I was much more effective as a relief pitcher.
Did it start that year, the relief pitching, or was that later?
Well, it was gradual. Almost, I think right from the beginning I was both, and then the stars dropped off by, I think by 62 even, I was probably more relieving than the starter.
What type of pitcher were you?
Well, control pitcher. Seemed like too good to be true, but I'd say the last half of my career, I threw every single pitch on the outside corner. Fastball, I threw the slider to the left handers on the outside corner. And real good control, and I threw real funny. I had a kind of a short arm motion that I think the batters had a little bit of trouble picking up because arms and legs throwing, it kind of came out of my uniform. And I would just throw them, I threw from kind of down a ways, but I threw a riding fastball. A lot of people say, oh, you were a sidearm pitcher, but I really threw a, because it was short arm, it was really a riding fastball. I just throw it in the outside corner, and particularly at Memorial Stadium, a lot of room to try to get them to hit it out in center field, keep them from hitting it down the lines. And when I throw them good, I throw a lot of pop-ups and fly balls. And, I'm not sure that the one thing I've been checking, when you're playing ball, you don't check records because you never know when you'll give up a grand slam or something the next day. But since I've been out, I've been checking. And the unintentional walks, I think, since they've been keeping those records, that I'm the lowest in the major leagues. I haven't been able to check all the records, but I had like a unintentional, like 1.27 walks per nine innings. And I've been Maddox and Tewksbury and all these other guys, people that I know of that are real low. I'm slightly ahead of them.
We'll have to have somebody in shape to check it out for sure.
Yeah.
But now in your last 462 major league innings, you only unintentionally walked 23 batters.
Yeah, that's over the last 7 years.
About a half.
Yeah, I got down here. Early in my career, it was about 2 walks a game, and then the last 7 years, it was about half a walk a game.
Do you attribute that to anything?
Well, partly, I always had pretty good control. Even college, I only walked like a couple guys a game. And like I was telling you, Salt Lake, there were like 10 or 11 games there where I, didn't walk anybody and plus won the game. But then with time, the control actually, I pitched equivalent of 14 full season in the big leagues. And after a while, the control gets better, especially like the slider. I never had a real good changeup too. I never got real good control of that, but the slider and the fastball got where I could, the control got better. And plus, I just made up my mind they're gonna just don't walk people. Enough people get on base anyway. And so partly it's concentration, and partly I was born that way. Partly it's just having played a lot, and then the third thing is just concentration. You really have to concentrate every single pitch, not get behind people. If you get behind them, they hit a whole lot better. Plus, they also got the chance of walking them.
Now, this is around this time Baltimore started getting better.
Yes.
Was this the year that they really challenged the Yankees?
Well, '64 they had a real good year. Actually, the Yankees eliminated them quite a ways ahead of time, but then Baltimore won. We ended up only 2 games out. The White Sox were 1 game out. We were 2 games out. And I think 60, yeah, 64 was the year the Phillies blew it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Baltimore, I think, was in first place or close to it for a while that year. And they started, actually, 65, Baltimore had a real good record. But the Twins ran away with it, so nobody paying attention. And I think 64, 65, and 66, I think 66, we didn't win many more games than we had the prior 2 years. But the other teams had gone, and especially 66, we got way ahead early, and just things went right. And we outscored the opposition.
Now, 66 was the year that they got Frank Robinson.
Yes.
One of the best deals of all time.
Yeah.
Was it for
Mel Pappas? Yes. That would have to go down as one of the better trades.
And after it was first announced, how did the players feel about
it? Well, immediately, there was a big, now, in other words, we've done well. We've been playing better and challenged. And suddenly they got Frank, and suddenly the perception was, oh, now we got the hitter, now we're going to win. And even spring training, it was all, this our Savior has come. And they only talked just against him in the first at bat. We play a couple inter-squad games before the exhibition season starts. And I was pitching in his first at bat, and the only time in my life I ever did, I said, I'm going to throw it right down the middle and see if he can hit one, because he thought there was all this hoopla. And I threw him a nice fastball right down the middle. He got base hit to left field. So that's the only time I ever, you know, even in inter-squad games, you don't really try to strike him out or anything, but you just sort of sneak it high away and let him hit the ball good, but try to end up in center field or something. But, that's the only time in my life I think I ever threw one down the middle intentionally.
And who were some of those players on that 66
team? Well, Brooks, Blackbury was a rookie that year, played left field, and Blair, center fielder, Frank Robinson was right field. Gretman played a lot. He did real well. He had a 400-something on base average. Good hitter. And Brooks, Boo, and I think Davy Johnson and Gary Dare, I'm not sure if that was the year they switched. And Aparicio was still the shortstop, 66. And Etchebarren had come up. We did have Dick Brown and the other right-hand catcher. I can't think of the name. But then Dick Brown, he was my roommate, probably the best friend of baseball, and he got brain cancer. And they called up Etchebarren in the end of 65, and he was confident from day one, so he was the catcher 66.
Seems to me that Etchebarren early in the season got, with that 66, got a lot of key hits which win games. Does that ring a bell?
No, I don't remember, but he did all right. I mean, and he handled the pitchers, even though he's a rookie. He had great confidence. I mean, and we had a Palmer and McNally and Wally Bunker, and had a very good pitching staff. And he just, from day one, great confidence that he knew how to catch in the big leagues and did a good job.
You had a pretty good year, too, 6-2.
I actually hurt my arm. It started out real well, and then I hurt my arm in the middle of the season, and the last half of the season, barely. I don't think I pitched at all, hardly. And then the end of that season, there was a big trade. I got sent to Philadelphia for a player to be named later, and they didn't bother naming the player until the end of the following season.
Who was the player?
Can't think now. He went in they had an expansion draft, and he never did come to Baltimore. They got $175,000 from him from Seattle or wherever it was. Picked him. It was a pitcher. I can't think of his name.
This was the trade in the offseason.
Yeah. It was one of the, December 15th is the trading deadline, and there were a lot of rumors I was going to get traded. And so I'm waiting, that night even, I'm waiting until like midnight to see if Harry Dalton's going to give me a call. I was traded. And finally, about midnight, I get a call, so I went to bed. 1 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings, and deadline is 12 o'clock, but it's 12 o'clock Pacific Coast time. So the deadline really is 3 a.m. Eastern time, and about 1 a.m. I got traded.
Who are you trading for?
That's the one the pitcher would be named later.
Oh, John Morris.
What?
John Morris.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I knew it started with M, but I couldn't.
So we picked back to the 66 World Series. I remember it when the Dodgers, Los Angeles, heavily favored.
Yes, because they had Maury Wills and Koufax and Drysdale, supposedly. The interesting thing was you got to keep Wills off the bases because he gets on and he scores. And you check statistics, and Aparicio had scored a whole lot more runs than Wills ever did. And I think Wills was fifth on that club that runs scored. Myth sometimes takes it over for reality. And we went driving to the ballpark. We stayed over in Hollywood somewhere and took a bus to the ballpark in the morning. And way over there, this motel had a big sign, "Would you believe 4 straight?" And sure enough, it was 4 straight, but not, not who was expected. Actually, all four World Series were, like, when I came back in 69, I played three more years and three more World Series. And all four World Series, the underdog won. We were supposed to win in 69, the Mets won. And a big red machine in 70 was supposed to win, and we won. And then we were supposed to be Pittsburgh in 71, but Clemente had the big series, and we lost that in 17.
Did you get to take part in any of the 66 World Series?
No. The only relief pitcher was Grabowski, came in the first game, and he was full of adrenaline. He struck out 12 guys or something in 6 1/3 innings.
He's supposed to be a character, wasn't he, Grabowski?
Yeah.
Got
the
story
about him? I guess that he was a kind of a very practical joker, and all kind of stuff. 66 was the year of the hot foot. He was giving hot foot to everybody. But the guys got too jumpy, so they finally, no, you can't do any players. Unless in the bullpen, if somebody goes to sleep, that's legitimate. Otherwise, you can't. But sports writers or anybody like that, they're fair game. So, I mean, four sports writers suffered all year. But the funniest thing was later, probably 69, somewhere in there, he'd been in Kansas City and got traded. And we're playing in Kansas City in their ballpark, and the bullpens were down the line. He warmed up just in the foul line. And they had the first base dugout, and their bullpen was down the right field line. A lot of them would switch because you could see better. But theirs was down the right field line. You could barely see the bullpen from their dugout. And Grabowski knew how things worked. And all the ballparks tend to have interconnected phones, like you dial 2-4 or something with. Get you the bullpen, and so he calls it. We're winning like 1-0 or something. The game was their starting pitcher was doing fine, and like the second inning or third inning or something. And he calls down the bullpen and imitates the I can't think of the guys the coach is the one he used to always call him Hopman, and he imitates his voice and says, "Get Krause up." Jerry Krause, the pitcher. And as soon as he said, "Here comes the catcher out of the dugout," went out of there, the was kind of set down, the bullpen dugouts were kind of set down. And up out of there comes the catcher. Pretty soon Krause wouldn't expect anything. He's got to find his glove. Pretty soon he comes down. He starts throwing. And it's like one out and nobody on base, or maybe one guy on base or something. No reason for a relief pitcher other than maybe he hurt his arm or something. So he's throwing, and we're just dying in the bullpen because their dugout, you can't really see real well, and they weren't paying attention, so they never even noticed it. And we're dying, and then pretty soon Grabowski starts to get cold feet, and I said, "Oh, he shouldn't, because it's bad, he really shouldn't have a guy throwing," because he was throwing for real. And we said, no, this is too good, we wouldn't let him call up. And pretty soon Krause is down there, and he's, "What's going on?" This, because he realized it wasn't, there was no reason. There wasn't a warm-up, any reason for him to be warming up, as far as he could see, or anybody could see. So recently he'd throw a pitch, he got warm a little bit, he'd throw a pitch, and he'd stand there, and he'd look, and then in between pitches, he'd throw one more pitch, and he'd turn around, and he'd watch. And finally, we let Mo call up. Their dugout, I don't think I ever did see it. Bonnie called up and said, told him what was going on.
Okay, so you went to the Phillies in 67.
Yes.
Who is managing it?
Balk. Gene Balk, both years. Although Skinner took over right at the end of 68, they fired Balk. 67, my arm was real good, and Turk Farrell and I were like the short men. And it was like 11-9. I pitched real well that year, and then next year the arm trouble came back. So got an outright release.
How were the fans in Philadelphia?
Pretty good. They're pretty good. They can be a little nasty, the visiting clubs a little bit. And we threw halfway decent. Not a whole lot. Not really bad or not good. They were all right. Not quite as sub-elements of...
Was Veterans Stadium up then?
No, no. I think 68 was the last year. I think Veterans Stadium started in 69.
So you went from Shine Park, wasn't it?
Yeah, Old Park.
And who are some of the national leaders that impressed you?
Oh, there were a lot of course, those days, Willie Mays and McCovey and Aaron. Over the span of like 55 when I started to 71, I pitched against Jackie Robinson and Musial and Ted Williams and Manilow.
Who is the batter or batters that gave you the most trouble?
Well, the I kind of threw five balls, so the left-handers with power were the ones that gave me the most trouble. And the one batter that kind of stands out because he doesn't get enough credit is Tony Oliva, who was as good a hitter as anybody in the big leagues. But he had knee trouble and cut his career short a little bit, so he didn't run up the big numbers because he didn't get enough seasons. But as far as ability, I mean, he could hit as good or better than anybody. So I always singled him out as being the hitter. Among others, I couldn't get out, especially I couldn't get him out.
And among the real good hitters, who'd you have the best success against?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to don't remember. I had real good success against the Yankees overall. And particularly what would happen there is that the Maris and Mantle would bat like third and fourth, or Barrow was in there, third or fourth or something. A lot of times I'd come in like Scowling, or Howard or somebody got in fifth. So they bring me in to pitch the first right-hander after now. And so I'd have some right-handers for a while, and I had good success against the Yankees overall. Pretty good success in general.
Okay, now after the 68 season, you got back to Baltimore.
Yeah, Phillies, I had arm trouble and didn't pitch very well, especially the last part of 68 season. They released me completely, and I called up Harry Dalton. And at that time, they used to carry like 10 pitchers, and they only had like 9 pitchers that had major league experience. I said, maybe I can catch on with Baltimore. So I gave him a call, and he said, come down to spring training, and we'll give you a shot. And by the time I got there, I had like 12 established pitchers. But I pitched real good that spring and made the club, and 3 more World Series. Very, very fortunate.
Good luck for them every time you were there.
Yeah, well, I was there in 66, and we went to the World Series, and then I was gone 2 years, and they, of course, 67, I think every starting pitcher from the year before, except maybe Tom Phoebus, who was like fifth starter or something, every one of them had a bad arm. And then I think one of those years there, Frank Robinson got hit in the head and missed a whole lot of time. But I was told, here's what happened. He got rid of me for 2 years.
69, you did well. 5-2 and a 1.91 ERA.
Yeah, the arm came around and pitched well. In fact, I didn't really have arm trouble again until halfway through the 71 season. And even there, at the end of the year, it came back a little bit.
Now, going into the World Series, you guys were heavy favorites against the amazing Mets.
Oh, yeah. Because they had kind of struggled and been behind most of the year. We only hit, they have good pitching, and I think as a team we hit like 160 or 180 or something, which we didn't score any runs, and they got the good pitching. And another theory I had with them was that with all that hoopla coming back from last place or way down, that and playing in New York, they got a huge amount of media attention. And Baltimore, there wasn't near the television or the media hoopla there is these days. So suddenly we're immersed in this World Series thing, and now we got to really go after it. And for them, it was just another day at the park kind of thing that they're used to it. And that's one of the theories why. But it was primarily pitching. We just didn't hit, and they hit sort of semi-normal, and we lost.
A couple of good defensive plays.
Yeah, you know, my theory there, if we had hit normal, like if we'd hit 250 or something, we'd have scored enough runs and been ahead, and nobody had ever noticed those plays. But the fact that we only hit 160 and only threatened a few times, and like Sobota made that nice catch, and A.G. made a catch a couple of few times that we did threaten, they did make those plays, and so they really stand out.
Okay, next year you repeated.
In fact, all 3 years, 69, 70, 71, we were winning 100-something games every year.
And you were 10-5 that year.
Yeah. Yeah, that was that's a trivia question. We had 4 20-game winners. Who was the only other pitcher on the team in double figures?
Okay, now, and you played Cincinnati in the World Series.
Yes. That's the year Brooks had the series.
Who are some of the players in Cincinnati right here?
Oh, that was the big red machine. Pete Rose. Pete Rose was lead off bumming. Helms, Red Long. They had a good ball club.
I think you needed 4 out of 5.
Yes. Yeah. They made it home run. Fourth game or something. Third game.
Now, your last year with Baltimore was 71.
Yes.
And you were 6-6. Mm-hmm. And then the World Series with Pittsburgh.
Yes. Yeah, that was the year Clemente had the tremendous. We got ahead, I think we were up 2-1, or I don't know if we were up, might have been 3-1 or 3-2 or something, and then came back, and Clemente just, they had a good ball club. The thing I always, like I said before, that like all 4 years, the underdog won, but by the time when you get to the World Series, the media will always jump on and say, well, this team's much better than that team. But when you get to that level, it's really, you're talking like 51-49. I mean, the one team is maybe percentage-wise just a couple of points ahead, and people kind of overlook that. But like back when they had the playoffs, 3 out of 5, I figured out that if one team normally played 600 ball, the other team 400, that the team, a huge disparity, the team that played 400 ball would win a 5-game series 3 out of 10 times, statistically. And so it's really not, even though somebody's favored, it's really not a huge upset when the underdog wins the World Series.
So what happened after the 71 season?
Well, I had arm trouble that year. And I turned 41 right at the end of that year. So I figured I was, too old, a bad arm, so I retired. Most guys when they retire have a real problem. They say, well, I could pitch another year or two or something. But in my case, I said, oh, I'm getting too old. And actually, 72, my arm was bad. It's inclusive batting practice, but my arm was worse in 72 than it had been ever anywhere in my career. So I knew I was finished, which was.
You gave it a try.
No, I quit. So I quit in 71. And in fact, it was a good decision because I couldn't have pitched it. Not only too old, but I couldn't have bad arm, real bad arm in 72 anyway. So thoroughly convinced that I was finished, no problem.
Okay, so what'd you do then?
So I had been, the year I got hepatitis at Salt Lake, I'd been playing winter ball every year. And so finally, so maybe I've been playing 7 years, I'm still in the minor leagues, maybe I'll be looking around for a second career. So I went back to University of Utah. I was sick and I couldn't do anything with hepatitis. I was quite sick from it. So I went to summer school and took a couple of accounting courses that seemed interesting. So I started working, I went a year and a half at Utah taking limited accounting courses. and started working part-time. When I came to Baltimore, I went, started working in winter time for a CPA firm here. And finally sat for the exam in 69 after Met Series, passed it. So actually the last 2 years I played ball, I was a certified CPA. And when I quit, I just took that up full time.
What would you say your biggest thrill in baseball was?
Oh, it's hard to say. The World Series, and then 69 is when the playoffs started. And I ended up giving extra innings in the first game of the. We played first, and the Mets played Atlanta second. And I came in extra innings that first game and ended up being the winning pitcher.
The very first
game, so I can say the first game, the first playoff game in the world, I was the winning pitcher. I pitched the Maris in 61 when he was going for the home run record. At that time, they said, we got to do 154 games like Babe Ruth did. And I ended up pitching to him like twice. He had a home run. He had 58 coming in. He had a home run off Pappas. He had 59, and I pitched against him twice in the middle of that game. And it was exactly like, never seen another game like it until I noticed that the McGuire's game where he was going for 62 was the same kind of thing. Nobody paid any attention to the game itself. It could have been the last game of spring training when everybody's nobody in the stands or anything. And they paid no attention to the game except when Maris comes up. It's like the bottom of the ninth or the last game of the World Series. Really weird.
The game, was that the 154th game?
Yes. And I didn't throw a single ball. We had talked about that ahead of time. Hey, if you get in a situation like that, you're going to walk them so your name doesn't go to the record book. And Bush said, nah, we'll get about it. And I pitched to him. Every pitch was either strike, struck him out and hit a line drive right at the right fielder. And every pitch was either a strike or borderline that he swung at. So I gave him a chance.
In 61, did he hit any homers off you?
Probably, I don't. I think he hit one maybe in 60. I got somebody from Sabre the other day gave me the apparently there's an encyclopedia of home run, and I don't have it here, but there's a list. I gave up all. It lists all 84, 87 or something. I gave up my career. It lists who the date, what the score was, and who hit it, how many people on base.
They also gave you a list of the four home runs you hit in the
majors. Oh yeah, I knew that. I know them.
Who were the other two?
I came back up in 55, so I've been playing at Lincoln, I've been playing every day. So I'm still fairly sharp. Joe Dunksall, I hit one off him, fastball. I hit a changeup, a curveball, fastball, and then, oh my goodness, Cleveland, oh, that's awful. Another senior moment here. Been over years and years. He pitched, and I hit a slider off him in Cleveland, and I think two weeks later they sent him out. His career was over. And they will come back in a little while.
Speaking of the Pirates, any Ralph Kiner stories?
Well, not too much. Although he was kind of the same. The one story I remember. He didn't have any kind of reputation. Now that he's become a broadcaster, he's come up since he's been a broadcaster. They've come up with once in a while get
the words mixed up.
Big words mixed up. At that time, there was none of that. And this is strictly since he became a broadcaster. And I can remember like the first year I went to spring training was. It was all train travel in San Bernardino, California. And you take a train from Baltimore, you used to go up, that's just trail now, but the Northern Maryland Railroad, there's a little railroad spur went up to Harrisburg, and then you catch the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh train. Leave here at 10 o'clock at night, take the sleeper to Pittsburgh. And then it's like 2.5 days more from Pittsburgh to California on the train. But they had brought some of the younger fellows in earlier, and then Connor came. And I remember the first pitch of batting practice, over the fence. And he had real good power. He hit high fly balls a lot. And they'd get up in the air, so they wouldn't stop. They'd just keep going another 50 feet. And he was a good hitter, not much of an outfielder or anything. And kind of distinguished. And apparently, the one story I heard about him, he had allergies or something. So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor examines him, and he says, "Well, Mr. Connor, you're allergic to grasses. So I would suggest during the pollen, grass pollen season, don't cut your lawn, stay away from being outdoors." The doctor had no idea who he was.
Didn't have a don't stay in his.
No.
I guess you got along pretty well with the umpires, considering your great control.
Yeah, I think, I used to, the players would go back and, "Oh, he robbed me of one or something," but I always figured they kept giving it to me, and I figured by the time I finished playing, every bad call back to the fourth grade had been made up for, and I got along, and I didn't, the umpires and the other player, I figured low key is the best thing. Just don't raise any rumpus. You could give them a little look sometimes, but not enough that the fans would. Don't show up the umpires ever. I mean, give them a little bit of look that the fans won't pick up on, and he might see it and say you're questioning a little bit. But be get along friendly with them, and they'll. And I was easy to call pitches on. The ball was. Fire wasn't real big, and the fastball was relatively straight, and so I got, and I think you get a reputation too after a while. And I threw it right on the outside corner. It seemed like anything that was, as long as it made a breeze on the outside corner, I'd get a strike.
I guess you do keep in touch with former ball players.
Golf tournament stuff. Like there's an alumni association, they've cut back some, but for a while there were six or seven around the East here, and you go play and you see a lot of them, a lot of guys you played with and against.
Did you ever play in any old-timers games?
A few. In fact, that's how I got started in golf. They had about 80, I guess it's probably 84 would be what, the 20? 69, I don't know. Yeah, they had an old-timers game in Chicago, the World Series that never was, because Chicago was in first place, and then they blew it, the Mets won, so they brought Baltimore out, and they had a golf tournament along with that, so I've never played golf much, let me try that. So I started playing right then, and I was a tennis player, played a lot of tennis when I first got out of baseball, and then I got into golf, and I had arthroscopic surgery, and been just a golf fanatic ever since. We had a game with the 69 Mets down in Norfolk, just a straight, I mean, it wasn't a preliminary game to any old-timers game or anything, just a straight game down there, drew like 7,000 fans. The 69 Mets, they've got their own, Chamsky, a good organizer, promoter, I guess you might even call him. They do well by themselves.
How would you say baseball is different today than when you played?
In a lot of ways it's not. The actual game itself is really hasn't changed all much. I think the guys are getting stronger, and you got a lot of pitchers that throw harder, and they're going to a little bit lighter bats, so there's more power, and there's a lot more speed. But the real game itself hasn't changed much. But the combination of the huge salaries and there's so much more fan interest now. Like Baltimore, you come out after a night game, there might be 10 kids there looking for autographs or something. And now, if Cal Ripken stopped to sign an autograph after the game, he'd be there till 3 o'clock in the morning time. So there's a lot more pressure on the players. So plus they make so much more money that they're a lot more independent. Now, and I think the managers have a lot more trouble dealing with them. if the guy doesn't, then they got agents. If the guy doesn't play for a few games, then I think the agents call up and say, you're paying my guy $4 million, he's got to play.
If you could name an all-star baseball team, the players you played with and against.
Oh, that's tough. There's a lot of good ones. I pitched against Ted Williams and Mays. Mays was a really good ball player. He had one of the best arms in the league. He was probably the best base runner in the league and had about as much power in the league. He wasn't quite the average, but he was an extremely outstanding ball player. Henry Aaron is another one who was, his baseball abilities were greatly underrated. He could steal bases, but back in those days, they just didn't. I mean, he was sort of, they figured, too valuable to be trying to steal bases. But he was a good outfielder and a good hitter, plus hit all home runs. So there's a ton of them. Because my career went so long, I played against a lot of big name players.
How much did you end up making?
Right at the end, I was making about $30,000, which is about major league average. So when the average salary is about $1 million something, so actually, if I was playing currently, I wouldn't be making all that much money. I would be making like $1 million.
About it from my end. Anything else that I've left out that you care to?
I got some questions.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
When you were in Pittsburgh, were some of the old Pirates players still around, like Wagner or Trainer or the Wiener brothers?
No, George Sisler was in the front office. And in fact, I had played against his son up in that Blackstone Valley League and got to know him. That when I went to Mr. Ricky's house, he was around.
Dick.
But outside of
Frankie Cutting did.
No, I don't think. Not many around. Just Mr. Sisler was really the only one, I guess, the old timers.
Were you a member of a fraternity at Swarthmore?
Yes, Delta Upsilon.
And
I got to say, when I joined the Orioles, the traveling secretary was Bob Brown. And I get out to Los Angeles one time, and I look at the pass list, and here's Bill Stover's name on it, one of my close buddies from college. And I say, geez, look who's on here. I asked Bob Brown, I'm like, yeah, he's a good friend of mine. I said, well, how do you know him? Well, he was a good friend of my brother. His brother was another Dick Brown at Swarthmore, with a fraternity brother, a good friend of mine was Bob Brown's brother. Small world. And then the other one, in fact, there's another, just recently, Swarthmore graduate went into Cooperstown, Lee McPhail. So he played, they had two coaches at Swarthmore since about 1925, for the next like 70 years, they only had two coaches. So he played for Bob Dunn, is who I played for. He played third base for Dunn a few years ahead of me. But the last, back in the 20s and stuff, they had athletes, then they kind of switched over to being an academic school. And I think the Ogden brothers both went there. I think they both played a fair amount of the big leagues. And then George Earnshaw was a Swarthmore. Between Earnshaw and the present day, I'm the only big leaguer. In fact, since I got out, there was one kid about 10 or 15 years ago, signed with the Mets and played maybe a year and a half in the minors. But Not a big athletic school.
Brent, you mentioned about Ricky and the fact he was an innovator.
Yes, yes.
And I understand he had a system called pitching to the string.
Yes, that was one of his things. He set up. He'd set up, put some posts back, and he'd put strings through the strike zone, and you could throw to him, and you could. you could catch behind it. The strings wouldn't bother to catch it that much. And he tried that. Another effect, it was one of his stories. I never saw him do it, but you get these young guys, and, I mean, every pitch is up and away and high, and they throw, just, you know, you throw them real good, and they all go in the same place, just throw them down in the strike zone. Oh, Mr. Rickey, I'm trying, but I just can't do it. So he said, I got an experiment. He takes a $10 bill out, puts it on a home plate. He says, if you can hit that $10 bill with a good fastball, it's yours. He says, you never saw such low smoke.
But did pitching to the strings help you as a
control? No, I didn't do it, no. That was just spring training you deal with, so I never, early on I wasn't even a pitcher then. But I had pretty good control, and I never...
As a pitcher, did you ever have fear of a line drive coming back at you?
Batting practice. Not the game, though. The worst was 66. It rained a lot, and we went down to the Naval Academy in the field house, and dark, and it's got tarps and stuff, so that everybody tends to hit up the middle. And you didn't have any screen in those days when you threw, or at least they didn't down there. I think so. Yeah, I guess they did have screens normally, but there was no screen. And right behind the pitcher was a big wooden board, so the guy collecting the balls would stand behind this wooden fence. And he was protected, but the pitcher wasn't protected. And I mean, these guys throwing to the big leaguers in there, and because there wasn't, I mean, the only open area was kind of straight ahead, they were blasting right up the middle. And I mean, I got jumpy, and one went right between my legs one time, and the guy reached it. And that was the only time I was ever really scared of getting hit. Because normally, batting practice, you'd have a screen. One time I left my foot sticking out, got hit in my right foot. It was just outside the screen, and the guy hit me hard back up the middle, and I didn't pay attention, whack.
So you mentioned several times in your career you had arm trouble. Did you ever have an arm operation?
No, not really. I had where I had arm trouble here, a cyst formed over it, and I actually had a full-scale operation. Dr. Bennett was a famous orthopedic doctor in those days. Ballmer sent me to see him in 56 when I was having the arm trouble. And this cyst, I actually went out to Children's Hospital in a full operating room and everything, and they took it out. And then I get back to Ballmer, and by the time Dr. McDonald was the doctor, was the team orthopedic physician, and I went to see him arm trouble. There might be a file here in the office, because I saw Dr. Bennett in 56. So he pulled out the file, and he's going through, and he says, oh, I operated on you. I didn't know who it was. He was the one who took this cyst out. But actually, I never had any, as far as the tendonitis or anything. I had cortisone shots, and this would sometimes help, sometimes it'd last a few days, sometimes it would clear up for another year or two.
About being traded, you mentioned you were traded for Hal Smith. Did you think Hal Smith, must be better than Hal Smith, right?
No. I wasn't an established major leaguer at that point. I just played in Salt Lake that year, and he was a good catcher. It was a real shock on the first trade, because I go to Kansas City, and all of a sudden I couldn't name a single player on Kansas City's team when I got traded. I mean,
how do ball players feel about being traded?
It depends. The first time, I've been in the Pittsburgh organization for like 8 years and up and down. I started there, and I played the 1 year as an outfielder, and then came back as a pitcher and did well, and then bad arms and so forth. So when all of a sudden I got traded that winter, that was a real shock, and especially go from a contender to a last place club was really, really sad. But then when I got traded, there were a lot of rumors in spring training in 62 when I got traded, I'm sorry, 61, when I got traded to the Orioles, a lot of rumors I'd get traded. And so when I got traded to Baltimore, I was fine. It was really Dick Williams for Jerry Walker. And I was kind of like a throw-in, so Baltimore lost a pitcher, so they wanted a pitcher, and Chuck Esigian, the Kansas City needed an outfielder, so Chuck Esigian went as an outfielder. We were sort of, Esigian and me were sort of like throw-ins in that deal.
But
that was fine. And then 66, my arm was so bad, and I was 36 years old or something, so that wasn't too big a shock being traded there.
But I was more concerned about the fact that most of us in life choose our employers, whereas ball players.
That's true, yeah. I used to point that out to people. They've done away with slavery except in one industry. And in fact, once you sign your first contract, you were bound to whoever, the way they enforced the reserve clause in those days, you were bound to that team for whoever you're signed with, you were bound to them forever. But of course, the nature of the being a ball player and the money was good. Nobody really gave it much thought until Marvin Miller came along, and he suddenly said, "Hey, Babe Ruth's day, the players got about 50% of Graves' revenues. Now it's like 16%. You guys are grossly underpaid." And he got us to stick together. I was one of the, in fact, I feel I'm partially responsible for the current day salaries, because Miller, I think Miller's like 95% the reason for the change in baseball, because he got the players to stick together and got the reserve clause thrown out and the minimum salary raised and got the players aware of working together, having some leverage if they stuck together, at least having a little bit of leverage compared to the clubs. And so he was the one who really created the awareness amongst the players and changed baseball in a major sense. And like Ricky, going back to Ricky, as I mentioned before, he's primarily known for signing Jackie Robinson. I remember sitting in the office talking to him, and he said, "Really?" He said, "I had two reasons to sign Jackie Robinson. Number one, I think it's the right thing to do." He was quite a religious man. He went to, I think, Ohio Wesleyan or something, and good Protestant upbringing and everything. And he said it for him that there's no reason that Negroes should be excluded anymore than anybody else. Plus, he said, if I can sign the good ones, there's a bunch of good ones there. If I sign Robinson, he does well, that all the elements will come play for him. And sure enough, Newcomb and Campanella and Junior Gilliam. And so he told me right there that he had dual reason that, number one was that it was the right thing to do, but number two, he says, I think it's going to benefit me too.
You mentioned that your fastball was riding or rising.
Yeah, kind of.
Does a ball actually rise as it goes to the plate?
No. It's an illusion. The curveball is actually curved, and the ball is moved. But the riding fastball, a ball, gravity accelerates, go back to school, 32 feet per second per second. So at the end of, if you drop the ball, it takes a little over half a second, in 1 second, a ball's going to drop 16 feet, because it starts at zero and at the end it's going 32 feet per second. So it's going to drop 16 feet. So in a half a second, it's, I don't know, 4 feet or something. So if you just throw a ball dead straight ahead, and it gets into, there's air friction and stuff that causes it. But the normal throw off of, by a pitcher, it gives a backspin. So when a ball's spinning, the bottom's got more friction. The bottom of the ball is going toward the direction the ball's going, so there's more friction on the bottom of the ball than there is on the top. And the ball moves away from the friction. And you throw a curveball that's spinning, like you throw a straight overhand curveball, the top of the ball has got the friction, so the ball tends to go down. So a forkball or spitter is like a vicious sinker, but that's what gravity really does. If you throw a ball that doesn't spin, and most knuckleballs break down, people don't realize it. Yeah, they do. But if a ball doesn't spin, it really sinks compared to what people are used to, because balls have backspin. And if you kind of throw the more overhand, if you throw overhand with four seams, so there's more friction, the ball tends to stay higher it looks like it rises because you get used to the normal trajectory of a ball, and if you spin it real good backwards, it'll kind of ride, pushes faster. It looks like it'll actually ride. It doesn't go up.
What was your major at Swarthmore?
Economics and history and political science minors.
Not physics.
No, not doing physics, but that.
And actually, are you an Orioles fan?
Yes. Yeah, I played enough games. My favorite expression is, you win some, you lose some, and some get rained out. Right. So, but then, I stayed here in Baltimore, and then, especially like around 79, when all of a sudden, the fan support picked up, and WFBR or something got the games for a while, and suddenly the attendance doubled, and I finally kind of got caught up in it where I started rooting, but I still tend to be kind of objective watching a game. I really have become an Orioles fan.
Don't you think they should have a general manager?
Yes. No comment. Sid Thrift was with Pittsburgh when I first started, so I didn't remember him all that much, but he remembers me from the Pittsburgh days. I don't know. He's kind of a de facto general manager at the moment. I'm not, don't know his baseball knowledge all that much, but I never kind of figured him as being, but when he came here to Baltimore, I said, well, he's got a job. I didn't figure him being very high up in the organization. But, who knows?
Nick, you mentioned a little earlier, you hinted at that, that you had something to do with baseball salaries.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Miller. I was one of the player representatives that voted in Marvin Miller, and he basically got in by accident almost. And, and Robin Roberts was the prime one doing that. He said with the TV money, they had 5-year contracts for the World Series, and that started going up and up and up, I mean, getting into the millions. And originally, the players get first 4 games of the World Series, the commissioner's office gets 15% on the top, but then the player pool gets 60% of the remainder. And initially, they got 60% of the TV money too. And this started going up and up and up. And then they started having baseball games on the weekends and stuff. We got zero out of that.
Game of the week,
yeah. It's another senior bowl, but I can't remember his name. And Roberts figured, well, we need somebody and pay him good to be more like the level of commissioner or something, so that when 5 years runs out, we got somebody can negotiate. We've got a negotiator, somebody's got enough intelligence and ability to present our side of this, so that we don't lose all this money that's coming in, and we still maintain our share. And the forgetting a judge, I learned his name. I forgot the judge from Milwaukee was the head of the Players Association then, but on a part-time basis. And he was friends with the owners and whatnot. And then, so Robert's proposal was to have a full-time. And they went to him and said, if we pay you, $50,000 a year, this was back when the average salary was like 20 or something. And we'll pay you $50,000 a year and give you a nice pension. And he said, okay, I'll do it. Judge Cannon. So they did go out and get some other candidates. And Roberts was primarily the one doing this. And he played golf with a company. He was playing in, there was a small steel company near Philadelphia, Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. And he's playing golf with the president of that one time. And got discussing his project of getting somebody. And the guy says, hey, I know somebody that might